You're listening to Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock.
Big John McCarthy has witnessed the best that the UFC had to offer.
That is it! Game, set, match! We have a new champion!
Your backstage pass to the world of mixed martial arts and combat sports. Only on the Ignotainment Media Network.
Let's get it on!
Hey everyone, welcome to Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and me, Sean Wheelock. Every week on this podcast, John and I give you an inside look at MMA and combat sports, always separating fact from fiction. On this week's program, we'll examine the 90-day suspension issued to Joe Warren by the Texas Athletic Commission, which could actually turn into a one-year suspension for Warren's positive test for marijuana following his win in Bellator last month. Big John and I will also discuss the comments made by Ronda Rousey's mom, Dr. Anne Maria DeMars, in which she called Rousey's head trainer, Edmund Tarverdian, quote, a terrible coach and a bad person. And we'll look at the latest high-profile weight cut gone bad in MMA, former Bellator women's 115-pound champion Zoila Frosto for her bout at last Friday's RFA 31 in Las Vegas. Plus, as we do on every episode of Let's Get It On, John will answer your questions. You can submit them via email, info@letsgetitonpodcast.com, and on Twitter by using the hashtag AskBJM. Remember that you can download and subscribe to our podcast on the iTunes Store. For Android, download the Stitcher app and subscribe. And you can go straight to our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. Well, last month in the main event of Bellator 143 held in Hidalgo, Texas, Joe Warren, of course, defeated LC Davis by unanimous decision. Following the fight, Warren was given a drug test by the Texas Commission, which subsequently came back positive for marijuana metabolites. Warren was thus suspended 90 days, which the state of Texas has now announced John could actually increase to a one-year suspension and a $5,000 fine.
You know what? This is getting crazy as far as these suspensions over marijuana. I mean, it's like, really? And you look at the levels that he was at, he was just above what is their cutoff is actually 50 nanograms. And a nanogram, when you're looking at what that is, to understand a nanogram, that's 1/1,000,000,000 of a gram. You know, you can have a microgram is 1/1,000,000. A nanogram is 1/1,000,000,000 of a gram. I mean, we're talking, it's not that much as far as, you know, the mass of what they're getting, but theirs is at a level of 50 nanograms. Above it, you don't pass the test, where WADA, you know, similar to what, you know, the Nick Diaz thing was, is 150. So it's three times. They allow three times what the state of Texas was allowing. So if Joe Warren was in Nevada, he would have passed the test there. So this whole thing has got to get, you know, to a point where everybody's getting to the same on what they're going to do, you know, as far as the amount that they're going to allow and what the, you know, suspensions and, you know, I'm of this opinion, you know, when it comes to this stuff, time is something you should not take from someone. You want to fine them. You want to penalize them because they're breaking the rule. They're not complying with it. I understand it. And if they're in such a state that, you know, that nanogram level is way off the charts, then you know what? Hey, okay, maybe they're flaunting it in front of you and you're saying, hey, we can't have you do this. But the whole thing of, you know, the 90 days, okay, he's going to do that anyways. That doesn't matter. But the 1 year, it's starting to infringe upon, you know, what's just common sense right. And I don't understand it.
Well, you hit on it with the 90 days. To me, that's not even a suspension because Warren was not going to fight realistically in 90 days. Now, developments happened in Bellator, and there was talk that maybe he would jump in and he would fight for a world title again because in the Galvo-Dontas fight, Dontas had pulled out injured. But generally speaking, unless it was the old Bellator tournament system under Bjorn Rebney, a fighter, especially a high-profile fighter like Joe Warren, is going to fight 2 to 4 times a year, so he's not going to be coming back in 90 days. But now you look at Texas saying, well, this could be a one-year suspension. Joe Warren this week just turned 38 years old. He had a great career in Greco-Roman wrestling, and before that was a Division I All-America at Michigan. We'll talk about that and how it relates to marijuana use in a minute for Warren. But
I know where you're going with that one.
You know exactly where I'm going with that. But at 38, now you're saying you're going to take him away for 1 year? You know, we talked about that with Diaz. 5 years was almost like a life sentence, and you wonder, would 1 year almost be a life sentence? It really is, I think, now the hottest issue outside of actual fighting in our sport of MMA.
It is. It's getting to the point where something needs to be done to get a standard for this, because every state is looking at it differently, you know, and it's getting to this point where fighters are going to almost start to, if they know they do certain things, they're going to say, I don't want to fight there. I don't want to fight there. I don't want to fight there. And, you know, that's their right. They can do that. And I think it's smart of them to sit there and have a concept of what you're allowed to do in that state and what's acceptable and what's not and what they're going to, you know, pop you for and what they're, you know, what is the things that they're strict about. All that is, it's almost a due diligence as a fighter. You need to know, because if you don't and then you get caught, shame on you. You're the one that's doing it. You know, and the thing is, you know, Joe Warren came out with a statement when Nick Diaz, you know, got popped, and Joe understands this situation well because he got penalized big time for what he did when he was in, you know, an amateur wrestler, in not going to the Olympics based upon testing and testing for marijuana. And, you know, he came out and he says, look, you know the rules. And if you break the rules, you know, you got to pay the price. And, you know, you got, this is what happened. So Joe's already kind of said exactly the way he feels about, you know, these types of things. But, you know, Nick Diaz is 32. If he came back 37, well, Joe Warren's already past that age. So when people are saying it's a death sentence for, you know, Nick, okay, it's an absolutely long sentence that he got. And, you know, I personally thought, you know, think that Nick could come back and fight again if he wants. He's that type of fighter. Joe Warren, being at 38 years old, if he gets the penalty, he's going to be 39, almost 40. Man, you're looking at this is tough on keeping your career afloat.
So let's talk about the backstory with Joe Warren. You just alluded to it. I alluded to it a moment ago. 2006 Greco-Roman Wrestling World Championships. Joe Warren wins the gold medal 132-pound division. So he is the heavy favorite then to win Olympic gold 2008 in Beijing. He pops twice for marijuana. He appeals. He ultimately gets the 2-year ban, so that knocks him out of the Olympics. And it's always easy to play what ifs, but it's possible if Joe Warren goes to Beijing 2008, wins gold, he just lives off of that, does clinics, seminars, maybe gets a nice Division I coaching job for a big wrestling program, never goes into MMA. But Joe Warren's case then was he needs marijuana. He battles with insomnia, depression. This is all public record. I'm really good friends with Joe Warren, but I'm not betraying any trust here. This is all public record. And also public record, which Joe Warren has spoken about candidly to the media, is that he holds a medical marijuana card. He lives in Colorado. It's just a part of his life. So we talked about this on the program with Diaz. It's not like you're popping for androstenedione, or you're popping for nandrolone, or you're popping for HGH, and you say, wasn't me, I didn't do it. As we hear some of the athletes say, somebody gave me a drink or I was on vacation. Nick Diaz has talked about the fact that he smokes marijuana in his daily life. Joe Warren, same thing. It's public record. So this is where it gets interesting. Then it's almost an issue of timing. And then I think the larger question, and we'll get to that in a moment, our poll question, why are these fighters even being tested? And then the threshold, as you said, John, and that's really interesting to me, the 5.3 nanograms, when the World Anti-Doping Agency says they allow up to 150 nanograms, that's where it gets weird.
It does. You know, and this is, I look at it and, you know, in my opinion, 50 years from now, society is going to look at us back at this time about marijuana and go, what in the world were you guys thinking? It's because I've never gotten this thing where I thought marijuana was this. Marijuana has gotten a rap, and it comes from, you know, this is part of politics and the cotton industry and everything that goes on. You know, there was what the money decided was good and what the money decided they were going to go against that was bad. And marijuana was the thing that they decided. And we got all these laws against it and, you know, can't use it and this, can't do that, you know. And then as far as consumption of it, we've made it to where it's, oh, it's the gateway drug. Nothing else is a gateway, because God knows alcohol isn't a gateway to anything. You know, but marijuana, everything, you know, there's only one gate and it's got a giant freaking marijuana leaf over it. But it's just ridiculous. This is the point. I understand why athletic commissions get involved in saying, or a World Anti-Doping Agency or VADA gets involved in saying, look it, we don't want you on, you know, marijuana at the time of the fight. Okay, because it's not that they're looking at it like it is a performance enhancer. They're looking at it saying, we think it's a performance inhibitor. We think that it actually makes it to where you are not as safe going into the fight under the influence of it, and that's why we don't want to have you on it. They're doing it to protect the actual person that's on it. And it's reasonable. I can understand that, because you don't want someone that's inhibited. You don't want someone that's under the influence going in and being in a fight. Makes sense to me. So let's put a limit on it that says, hey, or let's do something for testing that says, this proves that this person is not under the influence of marijuana at this time of the day for this fight. That makes sense to me. The amount of nanograms or micrograms or anything as far as, you know, this medical testing and saying this is our limit, it's subjective in the fact that those nanograms can change based upon, you know, the output of the human body as far as sweating, the exercise, the amount of, you know, energy that they're putting out in an event and then taking the test, what they're doing before it. All these things, you know, amount of water in their system, all these things make a variable on that. And it just doesn't make sense, since it's not something that's going to enhance their performance.
John, as you know, I think a lot of our listeners know, I'm on the Kansas Athletic Commission. I'm a non-paid, non-compensated member of the Kansas Athletic Commission. So I know with budgets, there's only so much money you can spend on testing. So if you're testing for one thing, you might not have enough money to test for something else. And as I look at this, it's a much different thing to be testing for recreational drugs, which might even be consumed legally if you have a medical marijuana card, or if you're in a state where it's allowed, or you come from a country where it's allowed, and then the residue is still in your body, I guess, with these marijuana metabolites, as opposed to being an outright cheat when you're using performance-enhancing drugs. Because, again, my state of Kansas, we've never had a UFC. We get one or two Bellators a year. We lost Invicta here. World Series of Fighting has never come here. So we're doing a lot of small shows, a lot of AMI shows. It's not a huge budget for the Kansas Athletic Commission. So we can't, as a state, as a commission, test for everything. So if you spend your money on one test, you have no money to spend on another test.
Yeah, and that's true. And all these tests are different as far as the amount of money they cost. And the ones that always cost the most are the performance-enhancing ones, especially when you're getting into some of these things. If you're getting a carbon isotope test, you're talking a lot of money, and you just can't do this on everybody. And so what, you know, is we need to stop people from doing things that, you know, steroids, performance enhancing drugs, EPOs, those types of things we need to be testing for. We need to make sure that the fighters are on a level playing field. When it comes to certain types of narcotics, you know, look, I think we ought to test for some of those too. You know, someone should not be under the influence of an opiate. They should, you know, that's going to inhibit their performance. They should not be under the influence of any type of metabolite that is, you know, cocaine or any type of, you know, stimulant in that fashion, because that is a painkiller, and there's all kinds of things that does. So there's all kinds of, you know, things that, yeah, we need to test for things, but we need to be smart about what we're testing for. And just because marijuana is easy to test for doesn't mean that it's one that it's important for the integrity of the sport. It's important for the fighter's safety. It's just not. You just can't freaking say that, oh, this is what's going to endanger the fighter's life, is that he's got 53 nanograms of, you know, metabolites from marijuana in his system. He's not under the influence.
John, with your background as a uniformed police officer for the LAPD, do you understand, because I don't, frankly, and as we've talked about this, I like my Bacardi, I like my Jack Daniels. I'm not a burner. Marijuana never appealed to me. Even when I was a junior high kid pounding down Jack Daniels, you've said too, you've never smoked marijuana in your life. So we don't have experience from that perspective. You have the experience, though, as an LAPD officer. You're retired, but all those years on the street in uniform. Do you understand if you're at 53 nanograms when you would have last smoked? Because to me, this is all mysterious. It's just numbers
well,
and
it's
words
not
that
a
I have
matter
to Google,
of-
like nanograms/milliliter.
You know, and it's not, this is where the problem lies, is that there are variables in it, in that test, that can change. You know, when I talk about the amount of hydration in the person, that's a variable that can actually change that nanogram number. The amount of exercise and output of heating the body up and getting into the stores of fat that the body's consuming for energy and putting into the bloodstream and all these things, all those factors have, you know, a certain amount to say with what that nanogram level is going to be. So that's why this is, you know, in a position that, you know, they're in, they're taking tests, you know, usually before the fighter goes out and competes. And then they take a test after the fighter comes back. And, you know, look, if you haven't taken anything, well, it's obviously not going to come up with anything. But if you've taken stuff, you know, you can be in a position where it's going to be at a low number before you compete because you're hydrated and you haven't had this big output. Well, then you go and compete and you sweat and your body burns at a high temperature for, you know, a 25-minute fight or a 15-minute fight. Well, it can change that number. And that's where this is a real problem. You know, it's hysterical, you know, it's part of, you know, just society. My dad was an LAPD police officer. And to this day, hates marijuana. You know, I mean, he burned it in my head. You do marijuana, I'm going to kill you. That's why I didn't do it, because he was a mean bastard. But, you know, he was okay with drinking. When I was a kid and I was, you know, 7, 8 years old, he was handing me a beer and said, go ahead, you know, as long as you're with the boys. You know, and that was okay to him. And that's just, you know, look at, everyone's got their things that they're comfortable with and people have their things they're not. And, you know, you're gonna hear people say that, oh, you know, that's what's going to lead to someone being an alcoholic. Well, you know, it doesn't, because I very rarely drink at all. And if I do, it's a single beer, as you know. I don't drink that, you know, anything as far as hard alcohol. But that's just, you know, everyone's personality is different. But my dad's got this thing that he looks at marijuana as it's a horrible thing. We will get into huge arguments over the difference between alcohol and marijuana. And, you know, and I win, I think, all the time, because I said, really, how many people on marijuana try to whip your ass? You know, he goes, oh, you know, and he gets into the drug dealers that, you know, he's done stuff with. And I'm like, that's not the person on it. That's the person selling it. Shut up.
So John, what were your experiences then? What were your dad's experiences? He was, I think, the founder or one of the key people of creating SWAT in Los Angeles. When you encountered somebody who was obviously really, really high on marijuana, really baked?
They're fine. I mean, as far as, you know, they have a slowed response, and that's part of the reason that, you know, the athletic commissions don't want to have a fighter that is under the influence, because you do have a slowed response. You know, you're just slower. You know, the world's going at a different, you know, time factor than normal for you. And so that slowed response, normally they don't get into this position where they want to have this, you know, ability to raise an anger level, and all of a sudden the testosterone's kicking in and then their anger is getting to a point where now they want to fight. It just doesn't happen. It does happen with alcohol all the time. We get, you know, people that, you know, they get liquid courage in them, and man, all of a sudden they're the toughest guy in the world. Now they're inhibited and they're slow, but they think that they're really, you know, going to do something because they've been inhibited, and their common sense, you know, starts to leave them, and they make bad decisions, and they get into positions where, you know, they do try to fight you, and that's fine. But I never had it with marijuana. I tell people all the time, look at no one that was ever high on marijuana ever tried to kick my ass. I've had a lot of people that were drunk that decided, oh, they wanted to beat my ass. And, you know, that's just the difference in them. That's why I just don't see, and I never have seen, the real problem with marijuana.
And I think that you've hit on it when we bring it back to MMA. So it's not as though somebody like Nick Diaz or Joe Warren are literally lighting up a bong right before they walk out. This is something that's admittedly part of their lifestyle. They use it for whatever personal reasons, and that's their business, not ours. especially to me. And again, I'm very libertarian, even though I've never smoked marijuana in my life. I'm extremely libertarian in my views on this. But both have medical marijuana cards. Again, Joe Warren lives in Colorado with extremely liberal marijuana laws now. So this is something that they're using, but then they stop. But as I understand it, these residuals, these marijuana metabolites, are still floating around in the system. It's not like they're cycling on performance-enhancing drugs and they're using it to get an advantage.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it comes down to the simple factor. If there was a simple standard that, you know, a Joe Warren or a Nick Diaz could understand, they would follow it and they wouldn't have to break the rules. But what they do is they try to, you know, they're not scientists, okay? They're fighters, and they smoke marijuana. So they try to figure out, you know, okay, I did it this way this time, so that's going to work for me the next time. And that just doesn't happen that way. And that's the problem. What we need for these guys is we need to have a system, and I don't know how to do it. And you couldn't, you know, you can't do it on the, oh, we're going to trust you on factor. That just doesn't work either. But there has to be a system where they can sit there and know, hey, I don't smoke for the week before my fight. I don't smoke for the 5 days before my fight, whatever it is. And they know that I can't smoke for this period of time. They're going to do it. They're going to be okay with it, and they'll follow it. But with what is set up now, they can go and they can end up smoking, we'll say, 4 days before the fight, and they pass. And so they go to the next show, and they smoke 4 days before the fight, and they fail. And that's the problem. And then that has to do with all kinds of things as far as the level of the marijuana that they're smoking and what, you know, amount of THC it has compared to the last one. And these are factors that they're never going to be able to control. So we need to, if we're going to say, hey, we don't want people on marijuana, let's get an absolute definite, okay, this is what we expect of you. This is what you have to show. I don't know how to do it, but that's, if we had that being done, we wouldn't have people that were getting popped for the marijuana.
Every week on Let's Get It On, we bring you our poll question. You can cast your vote on our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. Last week we asked, do you approve of Jaideep Singh as the opponent for Fedor Emelianenko's comeback fight? 91% of you voted no. This week's poll question... Shocking. I know actually some of the yes votes came in late. It was running 100-0 for a long time. So this week's poll question, I wonder if we'll get a 100-0 here. Do you feel that Athletic Commission should test combat sports athletes for marijuana use? Vote yes or no on our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. I think I know how this is going to go, but since we've been doing our program about 7 or 8 months now, we've never pitched the shutout. There's never been 100% consent. And I think that's great. I respect all opinions, even those I strongly disagree with, as long as they're well-reasoned, well-formed. So I always find it fascinating on our poll question. I know a lot of people listening are going to say, just like we're talking about, it's not a performance-enhancing drug, regardless of people's ethical views or legal views on marijuana. Maybe if you're just looking at it from athletic competition in MMA, in a ring or in a cage, or we've talked about combat sports, so throw in boxing, kickboxing, Muay Thai. This is not as though you're cheating like the way Lance Armstrong cheated in the Tour de France or human growth hormone, what we see in the NFL or what we see in weightlifting or track and field. This is more of a lifestyle choice. This isn't a performance enhancer. That might be the delineation point for a lot of people.
It is. You know, and it would, I would like to change the poll and say, all right, do you care that they test or do you care that there is unreasonable amount of fines that are being put forward with marijuana? I don't know if people really mind that they test for it, but I think that they're really upset with the amount of time that guys are getting for the use of marijuana.
Well, John, before I was appointed to the Kansas Athletic Commission and I started July 1st, I wouldn't have even thought about the testing. I would have looked at it the way you're phrasing that question, but because now I see the budgets and I'm privy to that, I think this is kind of a waste of money. Again, I'm not speaking for the Kansas Athletic Commission or the executive director, Adam Rohrbach, or anybody else. This is just me talking now. But I know that in Kansas, we have a really small budget issued by the Department of Commerce, and the money is only going to go so far. So these marijuana tests are not free. They're not super expensive, but they're not free. So forgetting just the man hours, woman hours putting into it, this is money that maybe could be spent better elsewhere.
Yeah, and you know, that's the whole thing is, you know, if we're going to do something, what's the best way of doing it? What's going to get us the most bang for our buck? And what's going to benefit the sport the most? That's the most important part.
John, do you think as we look back on this, maybe the way we now look at the early Art Davey UFCs, the ones you started refereeing from UFC 2, where fighters are in there and they're wearing gis and they're bare-fisted, do you think that we'll look back at these marijuana suspensions and even athletic commissions testing for marijuana the same way? Like, wow, that's a relic from a totally different era.
Oh, I think that's exactly what, you know, I said at the beginning. I think people are going to look and say, what were you thinking? You know, I just, because it just doesn't really make functional sense as far as what's it doing for the sport. What are we doing for the athletes? What are we doing for the sport? What are we doing for the fans by giving these penalties out in the way that we're giving them out, and for what we're giving it out for? And it just, in the end, I think, you know, when we, you know, learn more, because, you know, we're learning stuff all the time as far as, you know, marijuana is, it's a drug that a lot of people need for certain things. Now, I think there's people out there that, you know, obviously have a medical marijuana card that have no problem with what they're saying their issue is, but, you know, take the medical marijuana so they can get high and get baked and feel good. Okay, fine. But I do believe that there's a lot of people out there that end up taking marijuana because it truly is a, you know, herbal drug that they can take that deals with their problem, whatever their problem is, you know, be it they have, you know, MS or lupus, or they have glaucoma, or all these things that, you know, people end up taking marijuana for. Those people need it. Cancer patients and, you know, nausea and pain. Man, you know, look at, if you ever deal with someone that's got cancer, I mean righteously cancer, and is dying from cancer, and you see the breakdown of them, you see the pain they're in. You know, my stepfather died of pancreatic cancer. It's one of the worst things you've ever witnessed in your life, to see someone wilt away the way they do from this disease. And, you know, I tried to get him to, you know, go and take marijuana, and he was so against it because, you know, no, I don't do that. And it's like, why? Why will you not do something that can actually take away some of this discomfort? You know, there's things that marijuana is good for. You know, is it good for fighting? No, it's not good for fighting. You know, but we need to figure out in the end what we need to have as a standard for the fighters, so they understand what they can do, what they can't, and what we as the regulators of it are going to say, this is what we're going to accept and this is what we're not, and you need to follow this path, but we're not going to do all this testing, you know, for something that really isn't enhancing someone's performance.
Every week here on Let's Get It On, John and I answer your questions. Ask away via email, info@letsgetitonpodcast.com, and on Twitter by using the hashtag AskBJM. And of course, please include a pronunciation guide for your name. First up, Roberto Avellino, who did not include a pronunciation guide, so it might be Avellino. I didn't see the Enya. I don't know, but I think it's Avellino from Mexico. He asks, and this made me smile, John, why do you always clap twice before the start of a round?
I can't frickin' tell you why. I don't know. You know, it's just a rhythm thing. I have no idea. I get people asking me, you know, how did you come up with this? What did you do with that? I don't know, man. I'm not that bright. I just do stuff. And, you know, when it comes to the whole, you know, way I started the fights, that was Art Davey was the, you know, I tell this story and people don't believe me. And, this, you know, they sit there and, you know, Mills Lane had Let's Get It On. You know, he started that 1982, I think, with the Cooney versus Larry Holmes fight. And he said it before the thing. And you know, long before I was ever around. But when UFC 2 was coming about, Art calls me up and says, you know, he says, you know, how are you going to start the fight? And I go, I don't know. How do you want me? I want you to start it with a hand signal and with a statement. I said, okay, what do you want? He goes, well, I don't know. I said, well, I don't know either, Art. and he goes, well, what do you think? I said, Art. And then my exact line to him, I got two guys standing in a cage that are going to end up trying to beat the shit out of each other. I said, I'm going to ask this guy, are you ready? I'm going to ask this guy, ready? I'm going to tell him, let's get it on. I said, he goes, that's perfect. That's what I want. I said, okay. And that's how it started. That had nothing to do with thinking about it. There was no great thought process how I was going to do it. And as, you know, time went on, you know, Semaphore, who was in charge of the UFC and the production, you know, they always wanted, you know, make it grander, make it bolder, you know. And that wasn't me personally, but you know, I would try to do things to make them happy. And then it got to a point where, you know, now it's I do it a lot less than I did it in the past, because hey, it's not about me, it's about the fighters. And you learn things over time. But why I clap my hands twice, because it just seems the right thing to do.
Next up from Twitter, at Louis Lee J, he used the hashtag AskBJM. John, can Nick Diaz fight during his suspension in states not governed by the Nevada State Athletic Commission or in any other countries outside of the U.S.?
No, here's the whole situation. This is what people don't get. They don't understand. Nick is under suspension right now from the Nevada State Athletic Commission. When it comes to the Association of Boxing Commissions, which every state is part of that association, there's a, you know, it's not really even a written, it's more of a verbal that any state that puts somebody under suspension, every other commission will look at that suspension and uphold it in their state also. So when it comes to any athletic commission within North America, Nick Diaz would not be able to fight while he's under suspension. The only people that can take him off of suspension is the Nevada State Athletic Commission. So when if he was, you know, trying to go fight, we'll say in Wisconsin, Wisconsin's going to look on the fight facts index and they're going to see that he is under suspension with the state of Nevada for this, and they are not going to violate that suspension. The question is, going out of country where there really isn't an athletic commission, could he do it? Yes, there are places that would have no problem with him fighting, but what they need to understand on top of that is Nick has got a contract with the UFC, and that contract doesn't allow him to fight for any other promotion. And the UFC is not going to take Nick Diaz and put him into a fight, put him into a show overseas and do something that's going to cause a conflict between them and the Nevada State Athletic Commission, a commission they have to work with a lot. You know, they're not going to violate that. They're going to follow what that suspension is. And so at this time, since he's under contract with the UFC, the UFC did not violate the contract. Nick Diaz is the one they're going to say violated the contract because he got suspended by an athletic commission. So that contract rides for that 5 years. And so it's not like he can even go fight for another promotion out of country. He can't do that. He's under contract to the UFC. The UFC is not going to use him overseas. No state athletic commission or tribal athletic commission is going to put him into a fight here, and the UFC is not going to put him into a fight here. So effectively, no, he cannot fight.
This question from Jason Jones, and I double checked, it's not the Jason Jones who fought when I was the commentator in M1. It's a different Jason Jones. A really good question. John, please explain how the judges should score a takedown when the guy taken down gets right back up. We talk about effective striking, effective grappling is the code number one criteria. But this is a question that confuses a lot of fighters, especially fighters with a wrestling background who are seeking that early takedown.
Oh, or the late takedown, because their corner's going to get the takedown, and they get a takedown with 2 seconds left.
Yeah, steal the round.
Yeah, and boom, they get the takedown. Oh, we won it because of the takedown. It's like, no, you didn't. And it's hard for people to understand, but this is, you know, when we're teaching judges, what we try to make them understand is a takedown in itself, the actual position change from being in this vertical position to being more of a horizontal position is nothing other than a position change. It's what the fighter does with the takedown. Now, there are takedowns that are going to score points based upon the level of the takedown. If you get someone that, you know, takes someone and does a high crotch, we'll say like Dan Cormier did with Alexander Gustafsson. All right, first round, he gets a high crotch on him. He turns that thing over and he spins Alexander around and slams him to the ground. That takedown has what we call amplitude. It has height. He gets him up in the air and it has impact. He brings him down onto the canvas in a way that, trust me, it hurts. It sucks. So that in itself, if Alexander just gets up from that right there, the takedown is still going to count as far as it had impact. It's the same as when Alexander scores a good right hand, hitting Dan Cormier, that counts in the fight. Well, that takedown, when it has amplitude, it counts. But when we have a takedown that is a simple takedown, we'll say, a single leg where he runs a pipe and he spins him around and he gets him to the ground, or a double leg where he barely gets him, or he does an inside or outside trip or something in that fashion where they just end up slowly going to the ground, boom, and then the fighter pops up. There's nothing that has happened as far as a change in the fight. All there was a positional change. Same as if I'm fighting you, Sean, and you know what? We're in the stand-up, and I take a beautiful switch step, and I turn, and I have this great angle to hit you with a right hand. Okay, it's perfect, and you're not going to be able to stop it, but I don't throw it, or I miss. The judge doesn't give me credit for taking that beautiful angle. Okay, it was a positional change. I had a great ability to do something that could have been impactful in the fight, but I didn't. And so it doesn't do anything for the scoring of the round. So we get a lot of fighters that think that any takedown is going to score them points, and it's not. It's what is the level of the takedown, and then what does the fighter do with the takedown once they get the fight to the ground? If they take the fight to the ground and they end up holding on and they're getting hit and they're trying to do little things, trying to get position, and they're just getting hit, and there's nothing that they do as far as scoring with strikes or going after a submission during that time, then the takedown actually worked against them, and the fighter that was taken down is going to end up getting more credit for the strikes that they threw while this guy's trying to work for whatever it is they're trying to do with that takedown. So every takedown is different, and the way that it's scored is different. If someone gets taken down and they get right back up, we have a change of position. We don't have a change in the fight. Nothing is going to be scored for that fighter.
Remember, email us your questions, info@letsgetitonpodcast.com, and submit them on Twitter by using the hashtag AskBJM. Still to come on this week's episode of Let's Get It On, we'll discuss the comments made by Ronda Rousey's mom, Dr. Anne Maria DeMars, in which she absolutely lights up Rousey's head trainer, Edmund Tarverdian, and we'll look at the difficult weight cut experienced by former Bellator women's 115-pound champion, Zoila Frosto, for her return fight to MMA, which contributed in putting Frosto in the hospital for 2 days. With Big John McCarthy, I'm Sean Wheelock, and you are listening to Let's Get It On. Hey, this is Sean Wheelock.
And this is Big John McCarthy.
If you're a fan of our show, then you're going to love the rest of the Ignotainment podcast lineup.
Like the Ocho Man behind the eight ball and the Whiskey Philosopher with Jeff Cooper.
You can find these great podcasts and more at Ignotainment.com. Thanks again and enjoy the rest of the program.
Let's get it on!
When looking for new and exciting clothing concepts, look no further than Lambs to Lions. Lambs to Lions has great designs that incorporates the past from boxing with the new and exciting evolution of MMA. We all start out as lambs, but with time, training, and hard work, we can all become lions. Be part of the Lambs to Lions movement and check out all of their great designs. You can get your Lambs to Lions gear at the Las Vegas Fight Shop or go to lambstolionsbrand.com.
Now, back to Let's Get It On with your hosts, Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock.
Dr. Anne Maria DeMars is a highly accomplished woman who has a PhD as well as a Judo World Championship gold medal. She's also the mother of Ronda Rousey. In an interview with Latin Nation, which was released on Tuesday, DeMars said of her daughter's head trainer, Edmund Tarverdian, quote, "I think he's a terrible coach. I think he hit the lottery when Ronda walked in there." DeMars continued, and I'm quoting now, "And I think it's bad he uses her to lure people in. And the reason I tell everybody, and I told Ronda, I'm not going to be quiet about this anymore. He's a bad person, and people should not go there. And if he wants to sue me, that's my honest opinion." John, from the outside, it looks like everything is great for Ronda Rousey in every facet of her life. So this is really surprising. And as we're building up to the Holly Holm fight in Australia in the UFC, it's even more surprising to me.
It is surprising because Ronda and her mom, they're very close, and she's she listens to her mom, but I don't think that her mom controls her, and I think this is part of it coming out, where her mom believes that, you know, Rhonda should do certain things, and Rhonda believes that she should do just the opposite. And look at this, is Rhonda's life. She's a big girl, and as the parent, you always want, you know, what you think is best for your child. But I don't think it's best that she's coming out and saying this stuff. You know, she's right about certain things. Let's just be straight out honest about certain things, okay? Did Edmund, hit the jackpot when Rhonda walked in his door? Yes. Okay, she's right about everything she's saying as far as, look at, this was a world-class athlete. Yes. You know, all this stuff. But there's certain things that everyone needs to understand too. As a trainer, as a coach, you know, the amount of time that a trainer spends with that specific athlete depends, you know, varying upon who they are and things like that. You know, the one thing I will tell you I see and I have seen is Edmund is absolutely devoted to Rhonda. Now, is that because she's so good? Yes. Okay, let's not, you know, I'm not going to sit here and, you know, say, oh, he does it with every athlete. Of course, that's his star. That's the one that, you know what, is she's the one that is going to, you know, enhance his name. But he does put an incredible amount of time in with her. You know, he's there for her all the time. Has he made her better? Yes. Let's be honest. When she went there, she did not have hands at all. And you watch her now, she's got good stand-up. She's got good hands. You know, is Edmund the greatest coach of all time? I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to say he's terrible either. He's not. You know, he is a trainer, and he's got strong points that he's really good with, and there's things that he brings other people in that he thinks he's weak with. And if there's one thing you can't deny, you cannot deny the results of what's occurring, and you cannot deny that you see things in Rhonda that you see her doing way better now than she did, you know, earlier on. So whatever the rift is between, you know, Rhonda's mom and Edmund, and I don't think it's going to change. You know, unfortunately, Rhonda has to deal with this now, because she's going to hear stuff from her mom. Her mom's going to tell her what she thinks. That's who, you know, she is. You know, if you know her, if you ever met her, she is a straightforward, you know, shoot from the hip, tell you like she thinks it is person. And, you know, Rhonda's used to that. And I think Rhonda's, you know, she's going to do what she thinks is best for her.
John, you and I know something about strong women is the understatement of the decade. Our moms, our wives. But I think there are things that they say publicly, and then there are things they say privately. So this, to me, you would think is said privately, because look, her mom, Anne Marie DeMars, is a really smart woman. She knows that she makes headlines saying anything remotely controversial about her daughter.
It's crazy, you know, when you look at everything that's occurred in really a very, you know, small window of time with Rhonda and everything, you know. But, you know, Rhonda's mom, you know, she was, you know, Dr. DeMars was a stud in the judo world. She was a mean little bastard. She was known as the animal. And she's always been this, you know, high attitude, you know, high energy, just tell you like it is person. And, you know, that's what has made Rhonda what she is. She's, you know, taken a lot of what her mom has, and she's, you know, used that. And this is a, you know, point where they're as a family, you know, I'm sure Rhonda's going to sit there and say, "Mom, I can't have you saying that stuff. Stop." And her mom's going to sit there, "I'm going to say what I want to say." And she's going to say, "I'm telling you, don't do it." And, you know, I think it's going to be the same as every family, that the mom is going to end up in the end saying things again, but not quite in the same fashion. This will blow over. The real question is, you know, how Edmund's going to take it. He's going to be upset. But, you know, because this is where you look and all the time and effort you put in with somebody, and basically someone saying that, you know, it's worthless. It's not worthless. Okay. He's done a great job with her. He is a very good coach with her. Has he gotten other fighters to come in there because of his relationship with Rhonda? I'm sure. Well, that's what happens when you have that person that is, you know, that fighter that stands out above everyone else. Other people want to know, well, what are they doing that made it to where she's the way she is? There's got to be something special there. And so they go and they, you know, they're trying, you know, and there's nothing wrong with, you know, him getting fighters based upon that.
having worked in sports and MMA my whole adult life, I've been around a lot of PR people, a lot of media people. This is what gives them heart palpitations. Everything's going right, and it's that one interview. This absolutely sets publicity people, publicists, PR people, media relations people off. They do not want to do this. It's all about controlling the message. Let's keep the narrative. This is clearly off script. But Dr. Ann Maria DeMars, I don't know her personally, but I can tell you my first Sambo coach, Steve Scott, he's known her for 30 years. His wife, Becky Scott, was a contemporary of DeMars. They actually were the top two women judo players ranked in the 1980s. So they've trained together. They fought against each other, competed on the same teams. I've heard about Ann Maria DeMars for a long time, years before I ever even knew the name Ronda Rousey. So she's not going to be controlled, but you still think. People in the Rousey camp, people at the UFC, people are saying, maybe people at her studio, she's supposed to be in the remake for Roadhouse, people at her book publishers are saying, whoa, hold on a minute. We just can't have any sort of discord.
Yeah, they don't want to have family issues coming out. And you look and say, well, this is a small issue, but can it lead to a bigger one? Is there something else that's going to come out? And, you know, look at this is about fighting. This is what, you know, Dr. DeMars is talking about is, you know, her belief that her daughter is, you know, working with someone that she personally doesn't like. And, you know, there's people that my parents didn't like, you know, that I associated with. And that's fine. That's, you know, there's always going to be that. It's what does Rhonda think is best for Rhonda? Rhonda's the one that's got to make the decision. And right now her decision is, and she's showing you by staying with Edmund, he's a good coach for me. He helps me. I'm getting better. And I'm going to stick with what I believe is making me the best fighter I can be. And that's all you can go with. You know, there's all these things that happen, you know, and, you know, when she sits there and says that, you know, Rhonda is the, you know, the best thing that ever walked into him. She's right. Again, you know, there's no doubt about that. But, you know, all these camps, you can look at what's happening with, you know, Team Alpha Male and Uriah Faber and, you know, Bang Ludwig, and then we got TJ Dillashaw now going to the Elevation fight team, and he's getting paid, and now there's this rift between all this stuff, and you look at all this stuff, and see, this is stuff that happens all the time with smaller fighters coming up, especially with the Ultimate Fighter show. This whole thing with these, you know, guys coming in, and all of a sudden they're training under this coach, and they go there, and then the teams that got them where they're at all of a sudden aren't good enough because now, well, this coach trains here and he's invited me to come over here. And you get all these teams that, you know, they cherry pick other fighters. They're not the ones that started them. They're not the ones that made them what they are. They're the ones that are going to get the acclaim. You know, the Alliance is going to get the acclaim for someone going there after Dominic Cruz was, you know, on the Ultimate Fighter show as a coach. You know, Uriah Faber, someone's going to go to Team Alpha Male after Uriah Faber's the coach on the Ultimate Fighter. And this is what happens. And we get these rifts happening all the time. It's happening now with, you know, TJ Dillashaw and what he's doing. But you're always going to have, dissent within the ranks. And, you know, this is a dissent within the ranks when it comes to Rhonda's, which we haven't seen. It's never occurred. And now her mom's the one that's basically bringing it up, saying, you know, she doesn't like Edmund as a person. Okay, that's fine. You know, not everyone's going to like everyone. She's saying that she thinks he's a terrible coach. She's not saying he's a terrible coach because of what he's done with her daughter. She basically said that she thinks he's a terrible coach because when her daughter went to that gym, he didn't spend time with her. He didn't, you know, all of a sudden stop and realize, look at what you have, which, okay, maybe she's got a point there, but, you know, that's not, you know, easy to do all the time. And you always think that, you know, as a coach, you can pick things out. But once you start working with someone, then you do and you say, oh, this person's got potential. And she's upset with the way that he dealt with her in the beginning. She cannot be upset with the way he deals with her training now, because he spends an incredible amount of time on her. And that's to the detriment of other people in his gym. You know, he's going places to camps that she, you know, she's not training out of his school, and he's traveling to that camp to do her training. All that takes time. All of it takes time away from other people. So there's always going to be dissension in camps. That's just part of what, you know, the sport is.
Well, and from an outsider's perspective, we know in MMA, just because you're a world-class judo player, even if you're an Olympic medalist in judo, doesn't mean you're going to be great in MMA. Pavel Nastula is arguably the greatest judo player ever to move to MMA, and he had a really disappointing, lackluster MMA career. He was thrown in the deep end of the pool going to Pride and given yeah. Josh Barnett early. But he basically tanked in MMA. Rick Hahn has had a really nice career, but Rick Hahn said, look, I wasn't going to get by on my judo. I had to learn how to strike. Farid Kader, who beat Hector Lombard in world championships, a world-class judo player from France, has had a very average MMA career. So, again, from an outsider's perspective, just because you walk into a gym and you have a high-level judo pedigree or even a high-level wrestling pedigree doesn't mean that you're the next prodigy in MMA.
No, and that's exactly it. I mean, you ran down a great list of judo players, and there's a ton more. You know, let's be honest. Carl Parisian, for a long time, was probably the person known for having the best judo in MMA, but he's probably the least successful. And although he had a lot of success in judo tournaments, but on the world stage, he wasn't that guy. You know, Christoph Leninger was the first one that came into the UFC. That he had a hell of a judo, you know, track record, and his accomplishments were long, but he didn't do well. And then you can go and you look at all these people you're talking about. It takes that special person, and you know, Ronda is special, and there's those special athletes that come along. You know, when George St. Pierre was a young fighter and, you know, people were starting to train him, trust me, you know, he's special. They can see that he's special about the way he goes about doing things. And when he walks in your gym, you're going, oh, thank God. You know, you're
right.
Just saying, look at this guy. This, you know, this guy could actually be somebody. And so then you start to, you know, start to do more with them, and you start to put more time and effort into them, because everything is about the time and effort you put into somebody. And then, you know, that person can continue to be someone like a George St. Pierre or someone like a Ronda Rousey that continues to work hard, even though they are the best, continues to try to do things to strive to get themselves to the next level. Or you can get that person that all of a sudden the limelight hits them and they become a completely different person and they don't train hard anymore. And everything goes away under that realm. So, you know, look at all of this. Everything within fighting when it comes to being a trainer with a fighter, it's a crapshoot. You know, crapshoot as far as their ability, crapshoot as far as what they're going to do when all of a sudden the limelight hits. All this is stuff that you don't know what's going to happen until it does. And then you just try to work with it. And sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. This little niche with, you know, the mom coming out and saying she doesn't like something, hey, that's okay that she doesn't like it. You know, that's her opinion. She's the mom. She can say it. I'm sure Rhonda's not happy with her saying it publicly. But in the end, it's the relationship between Ronda and Edmund that counts. And that's, you know, that's everything.
John, I wonder if this story is going to go away quickly or if this becomes a Roy Jones Jr.
It's not going to go away quickly. There's no way it's
going to. No, it's not, is it?
Because the media is going to push it. The media is going to start digging in and trying to find out little things and trying to, you know, let's talk about this. Let's go after this. Let's interview this person. What does this person think? You know, it's going to build because now they have this little tiny foothold and they're going to try to sit there and pick at that wall until they can start to put a dent in the wall. And then when they have the dent, they're going to try to dig a hole all the way through it. And eventually they'll try to break it down. That's what they do.
The lesson here, John, no matter who you are, you can be embarrassed by your mom.
So true.
Well, last week here on Let's Get It On, we spoke at length about Johnny Hendricks being dropped from UFC 192 due to a disastrous weight cut. Now we turn our attention to Zoila Frosto, the former Bellator women's 115-pound champion, who made her return to MMA last Friday after a 22-month absence. Frosto fought at RFA 31 in Las Vegas, a card on which you refereed, John. You didn't referee her fight, but you were on that card, including the main event. Frosto lost a 5-round unanimous decision versus Jocelyn Jones-Liebarger. Following the bout, Zoila Frosto was hospitalized for 2 days, and she took to Instagram to detail her extremely difficult weight cut and warned fellow fighters not to drop, in her words, more than 10% of their total body weight, as she had done. This is another really troubling weight cut story.
this is exactly what we were talking about before. Look, this is going to continue on. You know, when I talk to people, and especially when I talk to, you know, people within the industry as far as athletic commission, stuff like that, I tell them your number one problem is weight cuts. When it comes to MMA, this is the problem, because it's not, you know, when you look at, you know, performance enhancing drugs, there's a lot of people that were doing it, and it's slowed down some, but there's still people doing it. But when it comes to weight cuts, you have 100% involvement, 100%. They're all doing it. And some of them are doing it to the levels where it is absolutely affecting their health and safety. It is to the point where they are becoming, you know, lesser people. They are damaging themselves for later on in life. These are all things that, you know what, they're going to end up catching up to the fighters here. And we need to do something to start to get an educated look and to have an idea of what we can allow someone to lose, what weight class they should be allowed to be in. All of this stuff is, this is the future of the sport.
When you look at Zoila Frosto, she to me looks like a natural 25er or even a 135-pound fighter. I was shocked when we had her in Bellator and she fought at 115. And I will tell you, September 2010, we had a show in Lake Charles, Louisiana, semifinal round of that one and only Bellator women's tournament. She has Jessica Aguilar. Zoila Frosto went through such a brutal weight cut, she was very close to shaving her head. She was as sucked in as any fighter I had ever seen. She made weight. She wound up winning that fight by split decision, but it was the most unhealthy weight cut I had ever personally witnessed in my life.
Yeah, and see, this is what people, and people don't understand what these fighters are doing to lose this weight, how much they're going through, how much they're dehydrating their body, and then they don't understand the actual effect that it has on the fighter during the fight. We get all these people saying, you know, the fighter goes out there and all of a sudden they, you know, they're tired. And they go, they didn't train. Oh, they trained their ass off, okay? They just put their body into a position where their body said, that's it, this is as far as we can go, we're shutting down. And they're trying to fight while their body is shutting down. You wanna talk about pain? You wanna talk about discomfort? You wanna talk about being miserable? What Zoila, was going through in that fight with JJL, I can tell you, when she came out in the first round, she was, looked okay, and you could see where all of a sudden she just, man, she was tired. You could see it, and it was 3 minutes gone in the round. She had 2 minutes left in the first round, and then she got hit with a hand that puts her down. And from that point, she was a diminished fighter, just accepting a lot of damage. You know, Jocelyn went after her. She fought her long. She fought her smart. She was listening to her coaches. And everything that Zoila did just didn't have that impact or that snap that it needed to have to affect Jocelyn in the fight. And, you know, this is what happens when a fighter diminishes their body in that fashion of taking all these, minerals and all these electrolytes and pulling them out of the body, then trying to force things back in. The body just doesn't react in the way that it's going to feel when you, don't try to lose that weight. You're going to feel much better trying to fight at a weight that's above you and fight with a full tank of gas than you are being in the smaller weight class and fighting in a diminished form.
John, the media is taking notice. Fans are taking notice. Regulators, athletic commissioners, executive directors of commissions are taking notice. We certainly are talking about it on a program. I wonder, though, if fighters are taking notice. If they're heeding the warnings of Zoila Frosto going to Instagram and saying, if you lose more than 10% of your total body weight during your camp, it's unsafe. Or if they're just saying, yeah, she just wrong. She has no idea what she's doing.
That's what a lot of them are saying. She just doesn't know.
They are.
She just doesn't know how to cut weight. No, that's not it. Because, look at there are methods to cutting weight, and there is a science behind it. But that science can only go to a certain point. And what she's trying to tell everyone off of, her statement is, she's saying, look at, I've made this mistake, and I just made it again, and it just cost me. My face is beat up. She's got facial fractures because she took a lot of shots in that fight. Her body is beat up from the weight loss, and it's now reacting and causing her problems. You'll see fighters, that they go through this huge weight loss. They go through the fight, they get on the plane, and by the time they get off of the plane, they got ankles, they got cankles. All right. Now, this is a pro athlete, but they got so much edema and water buildup in their body that their kidneys are not able to flush it out. And that's saying, oh, my kidneys are starting to have a problem. And, you know, they're sitting there saying, hey, look at this. And they're pressing in on their leg. And you're going, Jesus, man, you realize what you're doing to yourself. Okay, this is going to end up biting you in the butt later on in life. You can't continue doing what you're doing. But they don't look at it that way. They look at it, I need to stay in this weight class. I need to be this. There are fighters that are changing. There are fighters that are saying, you know what? I'm done trying to get down to this lower weight, and I'm going to start fighting at this upper weight. It's being done. It's not a lot of them, but those people will all tell you, man, I feel so much better fighting right now. You know what? I don't have that same mental, you know, downer that, you know, oh my God, I got to cut this weight. I know I got to cut a little bit of weight, but it's not going to kill me, and I'm going to feel good in the fight. And they're fighting, and they're fighting well, and they're winning. And this is what occurs when you get someone like a Johnny Hendricks who loses, you know, from the point of going to camp at 215 pounds, and then he's going to cut down to 170. Man, you just can't do those things. You either have to start changing your diet and staying at a reasonable weight for your body type and getting yourself where you're fairly close to that level. You know, if he was 195, we're talking 25 pounds difference. You put, you know, another 20 pounds on top of that. Okay, that's 55 pounds of weight. That's a huge amount when you're an athlete that doesn't have a super high percentage of body fat on them to lose. You're going to be losing it through muscle. You're going to be losing it through other forms that are not productive for you. And it's okay if you say, I want to stay in this weight class. Okay, then if you're going to stay in that weight class, let's start going through your cabinets and let's take out all the stuff that you're eating that is causing you to get yourself up to this level. And you have got to start being, you know, almost like a medical patient with your diet saying, look, it, this is now about my life. I can't sit here and just do whatever I want. Yes, I want to eat that Twinkie, okay, but I can't do it. And so the Twinkie goes in the trash. And now instead of eating the Twinkie, I'm going to have myself a beautiful apple instead of that. Okay, this is the way that you start to be smart in keeping your body at a certain point where it's okay for you to drop the 10 to 15 pounds of weight as you're training for the camp, as you're getting close to the fight, and as you get to that point of the weigh-ins and you have to drop 8 pounds, no problem. It's not going to affect you. You're going to feel good, but that's what needs to be done.
John, when you look at Zoila Frosta, when you look at her skeletal structure, when you look at her muscularity, she's a fighter who could be at 135, and she's still going to look really fit. 125 to me is probably her ideal weight. She's going to be lean, and then she's going to rehydrate. But going back to when we had her in Bellator in 2010, I thought, what is she doing at 115 pounds? And now she's put in a situation she hadn't fought in 22 months. She's thrown into a 115-pound fight, which is also a five-round fight. You know, she's not doing this on her own. She has a family. She has advisors. She has teammates. She has a manager. She has a trainer, multiple trainers. A lot of people are saying, this is a good idea to fight 115. We need you to do this.
Yeah, and that the, you know, when you look at it, you have to understand why. Zoila is in a position where there's two weight classes in the UFC. There's 135 and there's 115. And she wants to go to the UFC. And so she looks and says, I can't fight 135. My frame's not big enough. So I need to get myself to 115, where truthfully, you're right, she should be a 125-pound fighter. That 10 pounds of weight difference is going to be huge for her. But there's no weight class where she wants to go. And so this is where, although it's not the UFC's fault, it's not the promoter's fault, this is where promoters are forcing the fighters into losing that weight, even though it's not, you know, they're not saying you need to lose a weight. They're just, they're putting the fighter in the point where the fighter says, I don't have a choice here. I can't fight at that weight class, and I need to fight. I want to fight in that promotion, so I'm going to go down to this one. And this is the problem that occurs when we don't have these multiple levels of, you know, weight classes that are available. Now, Zoila could go to something like Invicta. Invicta is going to have all those weight classes. They have the 115, they have the 125, they have the 135. And that's what allows a girl to fight basically in, you know, a range that is comfortable for them. I've had Zoila fight, you know, I did a fight of Zoila's in Invicta at 125. It was a good weight for her. But when the fighter wants to go to a specific promotion and that promotion doesn't have that weight class, well, they're being forced one way or the other. And normally the fighter is going to try to dive themselves down into the lower weight class.
John, you and I both know, sadly, and it pains me to say this, it's going to take a real tragedy. It's going to take a death, basically, before something is actually done about these severe weight cuts, because fighters are cutting more and more weight. Last week on the program, we were talking about Johnny Hendricks. I contrasted when I was in Pride in 06 and 07, where a lot of the European fighters were not cutting weight. And now fighters are talking about cutting 30, 40 pounds from their gym weight, maybe 50 pounds from their out-of-shape weight. That's not what this sport was even 8, 10 years ago.
It's gotten to the point where this is, like I said, this is the biggest problem that the sport is going to have to deal with, because it is going to end up having a serious health implication or a death before everyone starts to say, oh, there's a problem. You know, we've been saying, no, there's a problem. There's been a problem for a long time. And the problem needs to be dealt with, because why is it that we have to have someone have that serious health issue or that death before we say, okay, enough's enough? You know, it's time to say enough's enough. You know, this is where we've got to start bringing in certain things. And you're going to get all kinds of people saying, oh, no, it's just more regulation. It is more regulation. But there's those times when you need to regulate for the safety of the fighters. And God dang it, man, this weight cutting issue has caused death. All right. It's caused it in amateur wrestling. It's caused it in MMA, although it was in Brazil. No one cares because, oh, it was in Brazil. Well, I care. And, you know, the people that, you know, knew that fighter, they care, because this is something that we cannot just push to the side and say, well, it's the fighter's choice. We should not allow fighters to get to any weight class they want. They need to be able to have medicals where they do that hydrostatic test. They're able to say, okay, you can no longer be a 145-pound fighter. The lowest we're going to allow you to be is 152. So that means you're in the 155-pound weight class. And that's just the way it is. And that's what's going to hopefully be something that's going to help the fighters with their health, and then doing things to get them educated as far as how to hydrate, how to rehydrate the right way. You know, the whole IV ban within the UFC, and again, that's only in the UFC. That's not in MMA. That's part of, because the UFC has gone with USADA. They have a whole thing on IV. So every fighter in the UFC now, there is no more IV bags. You don't get to rehydrate that way. So they need to be educated and learn, okay, this is something that you can take that's going to help hydrate you. This is how you do it. All of this is now another learning curve that we need to have the fighters getting up on, but we need to have them getting up on, look it, let's be smart about your weight first. Let's do this the right way.
John, I think the real test, just for Zoila Frosto, not for our sport, but just for Zoila Frosto, what is her weight in her next fight? If there is a next fight, and I hope there is. She's incredibly talented. I think she has a long career ahead of her, but she's got to be smart. I mean, she's going to look like an incredible hypocrite. And I know her personally. I've known her. I know her from Bellator. I really genuinely like her. But she's going to look like an incredible hypocrite. Next fight, 115.
You know what? We'll see what she does. I've known Zoila for a long time. She's a sweetheart of a girl. I really like her. You know, and I feel bad that, you know, she's had to go through what she went through with this weight cut and the problems. But you got to make choices in life. And you came out with this statement. Well, let's see you actually show that, you know, you're being a representative of your word and say, all right, I'm not going to fight at the 115-pound weight class anymore. I'm not going to cut that much weight. Or if I'm going to, I'm going to start changing my diet and getting my body down to a closer level towards that weight so I don't have this drastic weight cut.
Yeah, and then somebody will say, you know what? You look good. You should go down to 105. That's the way we are
don't.
Right now. Yeah. But that's the way we are right now in the sport. If she starts walking around at a healthy 128, they'll say, 115, you can make 105. I'm joking, but I'm not really joking.
Yeah, no, you're right. You know, and this is what, God dang it, man. People are crazy as far as thinking that, oh, being the bigger fighter in the smaller weight class is going to be beneficial. It's just not always going to work out the way you think.
We are back with you next week for an all-new episode of Let's Get It On, first available on Friday. Download and subscribe to our podcast on the iTunes Store. For Android, download the Stitcher app and subscribe. And you can go straight to our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. You can also find us on social media, facebook.com/letsgetitonpodcast, and on Twitter, at PodcastMM8 for this show and for us personally, at JohnMcCarthyMMA and at Sean Wheelock. To ask us a question, make a comment, or inquire about becoming a sponsor of Let's Get It On, email us at info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. That's info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. For Big John McCarthy, our producer Chris Lakin, and our entire crew, I'm Sean Wheelock. Thanks for listening, everyone. This has been a presentation of Ignotainment Media Network, online at ignotainment.com.
Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock, only on the Ignotainment Media Network. Don't forget to leave a rating and review in the comments section of the iTunes podcast store. If you have questions, comments, or are interested in sponsoring the show, contact us at info@letsgetitonpodcast.com or check out our additional lineup of podcasts, including Ocho Man, Behind the Eight Ball, The Whiskey Philosopher, and Youth Baseball Talk at ignotainment.com.